And I looked at my life. And I didn't want to be driven by fear and anxiety anymore.
Today on the show, we have a woman who immigrated here at the age of 18, not speaking a word of English, went on to found 7 different companies, and she's exited 5 of them. Her story is going to blow your mind. Her name is Sabrina Kay. She's a dear friend of mine, and it's coming up right now. Sabrina, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm so excited to get your story out to these people. I know you personally and know how amazing you are and what you've accomplished. So thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Craig. It's always great to be in this house. It's a fun house.
We try. We've had some good times together.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, I don't know if it's as fun as your house with your professional grade karaoke system.
Yeah, and we also upgraded with a different stereo system now. So you got to come over.
Oh, man, count me in. All right. So taking it back for those who don't know you, you came to this country, how old were you? 18 years old?
Yeah, I was in college. I grew up in South Korea. And when you think about that country, it's pretty amazing because after Korean War, it was all in the ashes. Mm. There was really nothing in South Korea. And regime is very similar to North Korea, if you think about it.
Really?
We had a president that was over 20 years. Mm. It's not really a presidency.
It's like
it was more of a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And he had a 5-year plan for the next 5 years. So he was planning to dictate the country for 25 years. Mm. He was pretty much I think he was really a good benevolent dictator.
Okay.
But there was, Korea did not have a freedom.
Okay, but as far as dictators go, he was one of the better ones.
Yeah, it wasn't like, North Korean,
person.
But, there's definitely the ranking system in Korea.
Okay.
It was the second poorest country in the world. And now it's 11th economy in the world.
It was the second poorest. I had no
idea. Second poorest country in the world.
So
that's one
of
the only countries, I think, next to Taiwan, that GDP growth is compounded year after year. Every single year for the last 50 years.
Wow, amazing.
And when you think about that country that has no resources, the only capital they have is a human capital. And they all came from Korean mothers who are just viciously competitive.
Viciously competitive. So was your mom viciously competitive then?
And she was on top of it.
Okay.
she was on top of all moms.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So they brought you here in your college years.
Yeah, thinking that this, America will provide better opportunity for their kids. And I thank my parents every day that coming to America was really a game changer for the family. Everyone comes to this country for the American dream, and we talk about it. But no one really understands what that American dream really means, especially for people who grew up with very little freedom, very little creativity, and very little opportunities, especially for women.
Yeah.
If I stayed in Korea, I have my girlfriends who were smarter than me, who had a lot more opportunities than me, but really did not do that much.
You stay in touch with them.
Yeah. I go back and I see them and... Mm. Some are doctors and some are like artists, but not many people became entrepreneurs or business people because, culturally, Korean women do not become business people. Japanese women are not treated equally. Chinese women become entrepreneurs. So, although you kind of get confused with all Asian women, there's very specific cultural biases in each country. And these cultural biases become our environmental ingredients for us to succeed and flourish and develop. For me, coming to America when I was 18 years old was really a game changer.
And so you spoke no English?
I spoke no English. We thought that, coming to America, the life will change because... my father left about 3 years before to have a better life for us and establish this. And it was very difficult for us to live on our own. And we all felt that if we study really hard, work really hard, and go to America, everything will be great. coming to America, my father didn't have a green card. So he was sponsored by the company who was giving him a green card. That's how he came to the United States.
Okay.
So he was in a work visa. He was stuck in that company, which was a janitorial company. Mm. So when the family came, he kind of felt, okay, I'm making $1,000 a month being a janitor. We have five people in the family. We're going to make $5,000 a month. We're going to be rich.
He thought everyone could just go to work.
And we did.
Oh, wow.
So we were all janitors, cleaning toilets and...
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So...
And that was when that was, your college years, did you try to get into an American school at the time?
Yeah. And I got into Cal State Long Beach because okay. I, you know, didn't have any SAT scores, and Cal State schools were to take with a good grades. I was a good student in high school in Korea.
Okay.
So it was translated into an American grade system, and they accepted me. And the college counselor told me that, well, you don't speak any English. You're already 18, almost 19. Your English is never going to improve at the level as the speakers, native speakers. So do not go for the type of a career that requires any conversation.
Wow.
So he said, you can have computer science or mathematics.
Huh, fascinating.
That's what I chose, computer science and mathematics.
Okay.
But because my English was so poor, they made me to go to ESL class for like 4 years before I took English 101.
Mm.
I hated it so much that I learned English very quickly.
Just to get out of that class.
Oh my God,
I
hated that class so much.
Mm.
Yeah, I was carrying audio cassette tape around, and when American people were talking, because they wouldn't talk to me, I would go just to sit next to them and just record their conversations.
Oh, no
and
way.
Come home
try
and, like, and try to pick up their accent.
Oh, wow.
So that's how I learned, because in the class, it was just, I was not progressing that much. Everybody
yeah.
was like refugees. There were a lot of Cambodian refugees and Vietnamese refugees, and they were mostly guys also because it was a computer class.
Okay.
And it was me and one other Japanese girl, and we were just being harassed all the time and just hated that school.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was being a janitor, and my mom, we brought just little money, and we put all the money to buy a little sandwich shop. And I took two buses to get to that sandwich shop so that I can be a cashier.
Oh, wow, you did that after school.
Yeah, well, actually for breakfast, and then I went back to school after.
Oh, wow.
And then I did a fluff and fold at a laundromat during the weekends.
You'd work at the laundromat?
Yeah, laundromat and doing other people's laundry. And
wow.
And at night doing the janitorial service. So that's how we started in America.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what
just
a
doing
way.
Whatever it
yeah,
took.
No, but what a way to start American dream, right?
Yeah.
We were so, like, it was just so weird because if we were in Korea, we would have been too embarrassed to be a janitor because Koreans are very proud. You know, we just had this, like, you know, we wanted to save our face and we wanted to appear to be wealthy, well-educated, well-mannered people and to each other. What I really loved about coming here is, one, we didn't know anyone, but also most people don't really care that much. You know, not as much as what I kind of felt in my country.
Yeah.
So it just gave me the freedom of whatever it takes because no one was watching us.
So in Korea, South Korea, people care more about your job even than America.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very important. That status is really important because Korea was in the ranking system with, you know, with the kings and queens and
got it.
Commoners
so it's top
and
down
villages.
All the
yeah.
way. You got
to
know
all
where you
the
stand.
Way to slaves. and prostitutes and, you know, and the concubines. Dang. So they're like, they're, the great system is not probably as bad as India.
Okay.
But Korea definitely had that very traditional ranking system.
And they had like slavery there? Was it unspoken or was it just open?
Oh, no,
open?
It was not when I was growing up, but you know.
But taking it back
from a few hundred years.
They just remove a few things, but the line of status is still the same.
Right. And they were not educated because they were just didn't have any access to any education at all. Mm. And when you're born as a nobi, which is the slave, then you're in that class. That's your class for the rest of your life, generation after generation.
Oh, wow. So you would meet people that was their class, even if they
were not allowed
slavery,
to look at anyone straight in their eyes who's not in your class.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, you know, we talk about it now. When you go to Korea, it's like a New York in steroids.
It's not like that today.
Oh, my God. It's like Korea is a very, very developed metropolitan country.
But just a few hundred years ago.
But maybe a few decades ago was 50, 60 years ago was a Korean War.
That's when it all started to change.
So, you know, I talk about this because there's kind of like DNA karma inside of us that we don't think about. How our parents were raised, they get programmed as a child, and then they just almost subconsciously, unconsciously program us exactly the way they were raised.
Right. And we as kids mimic their behaviors.
Exactly.
To create the bond.
Yeah.
Because it's all we know how to do so we don't get abandoned.
Right.
Because unlike a deer that jumps out of the womb and can go live for itself, humans need other humans to take care of them up until, I mean, how old does a child have to be to survive on its own, a human child? Maybe 10 or 12 or something.
Right. But also
even
society.
Then you don't want to.
Right. Society created and manipulated this family values to stay in the family until 18.
Right. And some other countries, it's even longer, right?
Right.
I know in India, it can be three generations living under one roof.
Sure.
Right?
And so is Korea. You know,
I was not
allowed to move out until like my daughter went to college.
Mm.
When I wanted to move out, my mother said, why would a single girl live in LA by herself unless she wants to be a slut?
Wow. And this is after you already got to LA. They didn't want you moving out.
Oh, my God. No, this is like when I'm like, I'm in my 40s. And my mom.
What? Your mom is still.
Yeah. I still live with my parents. Yeah.
What? You live with your parents and you're in your 40s?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just how the cultural, how it is. Wow.
It's like her way of loving me. She wanted to make sure that I'm being protected. You can't live in LA alone. That's dangerous. I'm like, I'm in a gated community. We are in a gated community.
Yeah, you're
in
one of the nicest
communities.
It was
a 24-hour security.
Yeah.
There has never been.
Didn't you buy the house for your parents, too, at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. I cannot wait to get into how this story develops for the folks at home. Because now you've had amazing business success. You've had three different businesses that you founded that did incredibly well. And we're talking about big business as well. So let's go back though. You're working at the Fluff and Fold. You're 18, 19. You're just figuring out English. What was your first step out onto your own?
Then another thing happened, which is probably the best blessing in my life. Growing up in Korea, we were all separate. Boys and girls are separated after elementary school. And then you're not allowed to even look at each other. Not talk to each other.
Oh, wow.
And my mother was very strict about that. And she said, until you're 18, you can't talk to any boys. So I went to college. Now I'm allowed to talk to boys.
Mm.
First time I saw people kissing ever.
Really?
Was in a college lawn. Because all the kissing scenes in Korea were cut off.
Stop.
I'm serious.
Even kissing.
Yeah.
You've never even seen it. Oh,
and all the PG-13, like R-rated movie, you show the bare back. Now all the Korean movies are like a soft porn. You know, like the country went all the way the other way around.
Wow.
You know, if you see Parasite or Handmaiden, oh my God, you know, I went to see that movie with my parents and my father said, mom does not feel very good. And he left. He was very uncomfortable.
Oh, boy. Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
But like Handmaiden is a very sexy movie. And that's like R-rated in Korea.
Now it's
and
different.
And here it's like not rated. It's NR.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So Korea is even more racy than the United States now.
It's like
maybe
totally
it's like a
different.
Rebellion from so many
I
years
don't
of
know.
It being compressed.
But
wow.
When I was growing up, I'd never seen anybody kissing.
So you see that at college and what is going through
your
head?
No, but you read it in like books.
Oh, got it. Okay. So you have an imagination. Okay. Yeah.
And when I got to a college campus, I see boys and girls kissing on a lawn. I was like so shocked. It was like weirdest thing that I've ever seen. And, you know, obviously you don't want to just stand there and stare at them either. And I very carefully talked to a boy that my mother told me that I can now. Then I got pregnant. Well, talked a little bit more than a boy, just to talk a little bit more. And I found out in a college health center that I was pregnant.
Wow.
And it was like I thought my life was really over because I grew up in a belief system that only virgins deserve to get married and have a happy life. Mm. And nobody would ever, ever want me. Mm. And from that moment, I think I just grew up, you know, because I felt that the child growing up in my inside. And when she was born, all I wanted is just to be a role model for my daughter and provide for her.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt this incredible responsibility that she is going to depend on me to live. Wow. And interestingly enough, I was sitting at home so my parents moved in to help me to raise my daughter. I was sitting at home reading a Korean newspaper with my dad. And I saw computers, you know, doing all these fashion stuff.
Okay. And was computers something that came very natural for you? Because when you were taking the classes?
Yeah. Okay. You know, it wasn't like my love, but I kind of felt that was a good tool for someone who didn't speak English because it's a different language. You know, it's a language that I was able to understand.
Okay.
And I was also starting at a kind of a fair playing ground
with
everyone else.
Okay.
And I just wanted to speak English so badly. And when I told my dad, oh gosh, if I can speak English, I think our life will be so much better. And my father looked at me and goes, you know, homeless people in America speak perfect English. So you have to have a different skill set than just speaking English, which is very wise. When I took computer science, it kind of like gave me that edge that this is a new language. I have a fair playing ground. And also, this is a skill set.
Oh, yeah.
So we were learning like a Fortran basic and all these computer languages.
Yeah, I remember that stuff.
And I saw computers coming into the fashion industry. So when we were janitors, we actually went into a lot of Korean garment district and cleaned the manufacturing and office buildings. So we knew a lot of their owners because, you know, they would just ask us to do some extra stuff. And I don't know what got into me. I was just really curious about how the computers work in the fashion industry because I was always curious about the fashion industry. And at that point, my mother was actually taking some of the scraps from these Korean merchants and buying them at a very, very inexpensive price and became a street merchant in Santa Ana and selling it to Hispanic people there.
Selling the scraps of the materials?
Clothing.
The ones that were
kind of defected.
Oh, I see.
You know, defected clothes that they were not going to sell. They would give it to us, and then we would sell it on the street.
Ah.
So we kind of became almost a merchandisers.
Mm.
And these Hispanic people were going back to Mexico while they were, you know, working in the United States. So it was really interesting for them to buy these really inexpensive clothes from the street, like, you know, instead of buying roses and oranges, and they went back to Mexico.
Okay, gotcha.
Right, so we kind of like had this little click to the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. And I just had this bold move, which was cold calling that computer company. And someone answered the phone. I made an appointment. Luckily, the person who made an appointment with me was the president of the North America, the software sale.
Okay.
And I told them that I know a lot of the Korean, you know, designers and pattern makers. As a janitor, I didn't tell them that. And if you teach me how to use these computers, because I'm, you know, studying computer science, you probably will be able to sell a lot of these computers because I can teach these pattern makers and fashion designers how to use the computers.
Oh, interesting.
And he said, well, we have an allocation that we made to donate to universities and colleges. So if you have a university, I can donate the computer software to you. Mm. I'm like, oh, that's great. Please reserve that computer software for me. Little problem. I didn't have a college. I didn't even go to college. I dropped out by then because I had my daughter.
That's right.
Yeah. So I dropped out and I was just working full time at actually a local fashion college also. Mm. So I first thought, you know, I would go to that college and talk to them about computers. They had no interest in bringing the computers to their school. And I drove to Lake Tahoe. I did a research, and that day there was a private college conference happening in Lake Tahoe. And I took my car, and my car was a big station wagon that just was like ready to fall apart.
Oh my, and that's like a 9-hour drive or 10 hours,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I've done that drive before.
Oh, you did?
I got arrested in Lake Tahoe when I was 19 for using a fake ID to buy beer.
Oh, God.
And I had to drive back up to go to court. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even drink until 2014. So
oh, wow.
We had a very different life. Yeah. So I drove to Lake Tahoe to go to that conference. And first person I ran into was the executive director of the association, and who was the undersecretary of education during Reagan administration and just like an expert in the field.
Okay.
And he said, can I help you? And later on, he tells me the story because I was inducted to be in a Hall of Fame for the association. And he was introducing me and he said, this young lady shows up in Lake Tahoe. I remember that moment because she was the only person I saw in these 50-year-old white male conference, Asian, young, and beautiful. And I asked her, how can I help you? And she said, yes, I'm here to start a college.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you just had the idea, you just do it on your own.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he said, well, have you filed an application? And I said, no, not yet. I'm here to find out. Can you teach me? And he goes, well, how much time do you have? You know? But I think he saw really the commitment, conviction, and determination in my eyes, and he helped me to where to go, what to do to start a college. I started in my garage, you know, not my garage, but someone else's garage, in a garage in Koreatown, and had recruited 6 students.
Like, when, come to the garage? Wow.
Went back to that computer company and told them to donate 6 computers to me.
That's how you got your computers.
Yeah,
okay.
That's how I got computers. And I showed them the license. Here's a California Design College.
That's what you called it?
Yeah. Called it California Design College. CDC.
Wow.
I didn't know what CDC was at that
time.
How'd
you get the 6 students? Did you just
No, you know, I know these people.
Okay.
Right? Because we were in the Korean fashion community.
Yes, they said, hey, we're starting this college, design college, come on in.
Want to learn computers.
We're going to supply for these computers. Wow, and it worked. Okay, that's amazing.
So they came.
Okay.
And then a friend of mine told me about this producer who was producing a fashion segment. And I told them that, oh, computers are going to be the next generation of the fashion industry.
Produce it.
Yeah. And I'm like, with me, like, you know,
wow.
And I'm like, what? And we kind of worked on the script together and made it into a Korean fashion industry, past, present, and future. That segment somehow just hit the core of the Korean garment industry, which had was the second largest population in the garment industry in Los Angeles.
Mm.
So Koreans kind of dominated
the
downtown jobber and, you know, all the garment industry, especially the manufacturing site.
Ah.
And I think the reason why it hit the core for that specific segment is because everyone felt that the language barrier to get into the mainstream was so high that they would never imagine doing it. Mm. And what I said is, computer language gives you the equal playing field for you to really go where you need to go. And in fact, it gives you a competitive advantage because not many American manufacturers understand how to use these computers. And Koreans, by nature, are much better at math and science because of the education system that we grew up in.
That's so more likely
you will learn faster and better. And this is how our future is going to be very different. And creativity of the Korean fashion industry can also come from these computers. It's not just a static computer language, but it will also give you the design abilities. And I show them the design demonstration on TV.
Oh, wow.
And then it just went crazy. People were calling the TV station, and then the producer said, oh, wow, you know, you had a really good segment. That was, so I started California Design College March of 1992. And that segment aired in April.
Okay, right then.
Yeah, so right after. And I've had like 25 students the next day.
Wow, everyone wanted to learn.
Yeah, and it was like I didn't spend a dollar on marketing.
Mm.
So now.
And were they coming to the garage?
Right, yeah, so garage. So I had to do like night class, day class, and also the evening class, the weekend class. So I had a 3 different shift.
Oh,
and
dang.
Now class is doing really well. I have like 30 some odd students, and it's like, you know.
You're charging money for.
Oh, yeah, charging lots of money, right? But, you know, we were not accredited yet.
Okay.
So we were, you know, still pretty modest tuition and building this institution. Mom and dad started working for me. And it's like, you know, we are like on track. We're ready to go. Right in the middle of Koreatown, April 29th, LA riot happened. And we're right next to iMagnon that was so rooted and it was all burnt down.
Oh, wow.
And my mom was so scared that we went down to Orange County. She thought there was a Korean War. We need to go to South.
Oh, wow. Were you there during the riots? You, like, personally?
So Wednesday night was a payroll. I was sitting in my office doing my payroll. The security guard came and knocked on the door and said, you got to get out. And I said, why? There's a riot. And I said, no, I need to do payroll. And said, I'm going to send all the students home. Go, no, you can't do that. We don't have time to do makeup class. And they said, no, you don't understand. There's a fire and guns everywhere. And he kicked everybody out. And I was so much in a zone, I didn't know what was happening until security really knocked on the door. And everyone left. And the next day, my mom was so scared. She took everybody, the entire family, to South, in our uncle's house.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was watching TV, and they were showing iMagnet, and right next to it is my school, and I can see about half of it, but I see I Magnum burning down, and everything was all, you know, like rooted. And I really want to go and, you know, save the school. And there are computers inside, right? And my mom said, there's no way you're going to go. So I snuck out early in the morning, very early, like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I went there. And, you know, just a silly, silly little thing. Because it was a garage space, we had these, like, a garage door. No one could get in.
Oh, because the metal door.
It was a metal garage door.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, when we closed it, we locked that door.
Yeah.
And it's just like a small little pedal lock. But nobody knew what it was inside.
Okay.
Or nobody even guessed there were, like, very expensive
computers
inside.
They're just going for the easy stuff, windows and things like that they can break. Wow. Right. Was there still stuff going on when you got there? Or was it that street was cleared out?
So I smelled gunfire. I smelled the fire. But it was 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, God.
So there were not many people. There were designer shoes on the street. I mean, it was like a, such a sad, sad part of humanity that you saw.
Wow.
And
did you get your computers, or did you leave it because you felt
that I left it there.
The storm had passed?
The producer called me and asked me, we need your help. So I was in Los Angeles. We need your help. And there's a student rally at UCLA that media is portraying Koreans and African Americans as if, you know, this is Korean-African war, African-American war. Mm. And we don't feel that way. How do you feel? You're absolutely right. This is not a racial issue. This is more of a socioeconomical issue. And there are a lot of people who are suffering, and there are a lot of people who are, you know, very scared. And this is why it happened. It's not just a racial issue, and we have to look at this as a totality. I went there with a cameraman that I worked with, and the rally was at 2 o'clock. It's pouring rain, and I did a whole segment and came back. We didn't have time to dub the audio. So there was video on the screen, and I was live audio dubbing with no script.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And after the segment was done.
It was on the news station?
Yeah, it was Channel 18, KTLA, and in Korean.
Wow.
And I, you know, had my hair all soaking wet, and I, you know, basically did a live audio dubbing. After that was done, everyone gave me standing ovation. I get a phone call from my mom. Why does your hair look so terrible?
My gosh.
I'm like, because, Mom, I came directly from the rally.
Mm.
But that segment put me on the map.
Mm.
The next day, the newspaper had a full-page article about my story as a next generation of the leader. And the producer gave me a TV segment, 20-minute TV segment called Assimilating into America with Sabrina.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I got called into the radio station, and, you know, magazines start calling me to write newspaper columns and magazine columns about the fashion industry. I became like a fashion expert the next day.
Wow.
We spent $0 in advertising. Whatever I was selling, people were buying.
And more students.
More students were coming. I became like Oprah Winfrey of Koreatown. That's what a lot of people were saying.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I, you know, I would call a Korean restaurant, and they would recognize my voice.
Really?
For food delivery.
No
and
kidding.
And all I have to say is, oh, I want dumpling soup. And go, oh, my God, is this a Sabrina Kay?
Wow.
And that's how, like, people were recognizing my voice, recognizing what we were doing. And it was such a, like, special.
It was transforming the community.
Yeah. And also, it was just transformational for me. I was a 20-something who didn't know anything. And then I met this advertising executive who was very, very good to me. He came to me to do, actually, American Express commercial. you know, because I was an American Express customer and they wanted to do these entrepreneurial stores. Mm. And then he goes, you are much more than that. Let me help you to grow this college. And he took on our school at like a 10% of what he usually charges. And he said, I buy this massive TV ads and radio ads, and I'm going to give it to you for cost. Mm. And for me, still, it was a lot of money.
Okay.
But once we started doing TV and radio ads, school started like tripling, quadrupling every single year.
I remember seeing those ads as growing up in LA.
Yeah.
I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. And wow. We also did fashion shows everywhere. Usually fashion shows are anywhere from, you know, $50,000 to $200,000, even small fashion shows to produce. And if you look at mega fashion shows like Victoria's Secret or Chanel shows, it's going to the millions. But small community shows, you need $50,000 to do it. I figured out with my models, there were like about five models who I was so good, you know, friends with. And they were all dancers. So we choreographed the entire fashion show to be 10 minutes doing dancing. And while two are dancing, two would go in and change and one will come out and dance. Right. So it was just very entertaining. So we became kind of like opening act of all charity events.
Oh, wow.
And by doing that, you know, all the parents end up seeing the fashion shows. And then I introduced the designers who are our students at the end.
Right.
So now, like, all the Americans are coming into California
wow.
Design College.
Wow.
So I kind of like it.
Making the student designers into superstars with the fashion show.
Sure, sure.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And then by the time it hit about 10th year, you know, now I'm financially very, very, very comfortable. You know, we started knocking off Chanel and producing our own, you know, knockoffs.
Oh,
because
wow.
the students are, you know, doing all the work.
And were you accredited by this point?
Oh, yeah.
And it was
We've been
all...
accredited and, yeah. you know, it just like became one of the fourth largest fashion colleges in the country.
In the country?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the founder of Art Institute, Bob Newson, came to have lunch with me. He was a kind of like a magazine cover in the education sector because he's a visionary and mm-hmm. just really an amazing human being. So I was like very flattered to have lunch with him. He said, you know, and he wanted to have a tour, gave him a tour of the school.
Yeah, so he was kind of overseeing the competitor, the Art Institute, in
yeah.
a way, and you were a company
yeah.
design college.
Yeah,
okay.
It was kind of a competitor.
But he was
but,
the big,
you know,
big fish.
Yeah,
okay.
Because Art Institute had 57 campuses, right? And we were just one campus school.
Got it.
And he came to see me, and we had lunch, and he said, you know, I have a plane, I need to go to Orange County, but I don't want to, you know, use up that much of, you know, gas and, you know, hurt the environment. And I'm like, oh, that's really nice. And go, why don't I give you a ride? Then we can continuously talk. He said, oh, yeah, okay. And the drive from Los Angeles to Orange County that hour was a murder. It took like 3 hours to get
there. Oh, one of those days, yeah.
By the time he was getting out of the car, we're shaking hands on selling the company. We already had all the terms and the price and everything all worked out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was your first exit then.
That was my first exit.
Amazing.
And then
California Design College became a part of Art Institute.
And I became the CEO of Special Projects. And the whole thing was sold to Goldman Sachs.
The whole Art Institute.
The whole
and
Art
you were
Institute
the CEO of the Special
Projects Division.
Project Division.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And after that was done, my mom was really fearful that I don't have a job anymore and I don't have a college degree. And we were so ashamed that I didn't have a college degree that we didn't talk about it at all.
But you had just made, I assume, a good amount of money?
Oh, yeah, I had enough money to retire.
But your mom was like, where's the college degree?
Yeah, it was.
Oh,
and
wow.
Also, you're not going to get a job because you never had a real job before. And I was
like, you're like, Mom, I'm not going to get a job because
yeah,
I'm...
Yeah, I said, Mom, cover of Fortune magazine. It's okay. And she's like, oh, you're in the magazines all the time. That doesn't give you anything. Because she saw me in Korean magazines all the time, so she doesn't know the difference.
She doesn't know when you're on Fortune magazine, that's not the, oh my yeah. gosh.
So, and then, you know, it kind of like made sense. I kind of felt that I wasn't authentic to myself because I operated a college for 10 years and telling everyone that you need to go to college and have your career, I never finished. I was so ashamed. That was one of the things that I was stressing about, that if anyone finds out that I didn't go to college, I'll be this imposter. How do I explain this, that I didn't even go to college? So I really wanted to go to college.
Okay.
I got very lucky. USC Dean sent me a actually handwritten note. He was there only just very few, you know, years, but he saw the article in the magazine, the Fortune magazine, and said, you know, very impressed with your story. I would like to have lunch with you. And I told them that I really wanted to go to school. And by that time, I went back to Cal State Long Beach and asked, like, how can I come back? And they said it will take you another four or five years to graduate because graduation requirements have changed and you still haven't finished your ESL yet.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
So I had to go and take my ESL classes and I'm like, there's no way I'm going to do that.
Wow.
And go to school for 5 years. That's crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? 5 years seemed like eternity to me. But USC Dean told me that he could accept me to an MBA program. And I just need to go and take a GMAT. I hired five tutors and nailed the GMAT. And literally started a month later.
That's great. And then you're an MBA, which is exciting.
Sure.
Learning things you can maybe use
and
in the next venture.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
While doing the MBA, it was by theme, each theme, I had a business idea. And three of them actually became real business.
No way.
Yeah. One of them is called Fashion Umbrella.
Okay.
The first idea was kind of like Project Runway. And I actually went and pitched about it to TV stations, but I still say that I was the original Project Runway before Project Runway was. And basically, Fashion Umbrella was doing the back office functions so that all the designers can just design. Because I had a background, you know, teaching them, mentoring them. So before there was any accelerator, it was more like a fashion accelerator. And it worked out very well. We were able to present a lot of the LA designers to Asia. And
oh, cool.
That was our connection to Korea and China. Nice. And we went for the fashion shows there in both countries, and the designers were able to promote their designs internationally. The second, I think it was a theme eight, a corporate strategy, one of the founders of our USC EMBA program was the consultant to home savings and loans person, Tim Campbell. And he was one of my favorite professors. I was talking to him and he was telling me about how Korean banks have done so well. And coincidentally, my business partner and also was a landlord of California Design College is one of the largest, you know, real estate developers in Los Angeles. He was talking about starting a bank. So I put everyone together with my real estate partner and put a board of Premier Business Bank. And 2006, we opened a bank.
Premier Business Bank.
Premier Business Bank.
Wow.
And that was really the worst time to open a bank.
That's right, because a couple of years later, things went downhill.
But
right?
Were you hands-on
in operations in the bank too?
Yeah, but at that time, it was the best thing to do. We were oversubscribed, people wanted to be part of it. 2008 happened, you know, all the banks were going bankrupt. We were like really hanging by a little thread to survive. We didn't have any bad loans like a lot of the banks. 2010 comes, you know, needed more money. So like I keep putting money in, keep raising more money. And because banks, you know, the government was taking out all the competition and was not giving any licenses, we were able to buy other banks and other, you know, startups.
Oh, wow.
So we kind of grew in a weird organic and M&A way. And I sold it to First Foundation Bank last year.
Wow.
So that's a really kind of like a great story that started in the MBA project.
Yeah. Wow. Just as a result of going back to school, yeah. You started a bank.
Yeah,
and sold
yeah.
The bank.
I was a fashion designer. Wow. I didn't know anything about banking.
Wow. You know? And I know you did a commencement address.
Right. Right.
At
USC.
Yeah. Yeah. When was that?
That was 2 years ago, 2017.
That's so amazing. So they had you back to speak to the graduates.
So
incredible.
That was really kind of like awesome to go back to school because I did not know I was able to graduate. I couldn't graduate from Cal State Long Beach. USC MBA was like pie in the sky for me. And for me to graduate from MBA program, my mom was so happy. She was just so proud of me. And then my professor was, like, I told my professor that I had such a great time. I don't want to graduate. And he goes, you passed. You need to graduate. And he goes, why don't you go and get a PhD? So I gave him an application with a recommendation from Wharton in University of Pennsylvania. And he looked at me and he goes, you know, this is Philadelphia. I said, yeah. And he goes, you know, I was kidding about going back to school. And I said, no, that's a great idea. So he filled out the recommendation form for me. And I now have the bank. And at that time, I kind of felt like this great duty to give back. And I met this incredible mentor. By being in some of the, you know, charitable organizations. His name is Ambassador Frank Baxter. And Frank kind of like gave me the type of parenting that my parents were not able to do in America as a friend because my parents were incredible in Korea, but coming to America, they didn't know, you know, how the society worked. We didn't know anyone here. We didn't have any connections. Where Frank and Kathy, his wife is an opera singer. So, you know, they introduced me to opera, which I absolutely love now. And I also grew up with opera with my dad. So it was like, you know, just such a great connection together.
Yeah.
And he really showed me how to give back. So I was now on 21 charitable boards.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, you were telling me about that, and you're known in the Los Angeles community as someone who has made so much impact with your philanthropic work.
Yeah.
I know you did a lot with After School All Stars and Peterson Museum and so many other things. It's amazing.
But I think looking back, I think I was just lost, you know?
Mm.
And when you're a workaholic, you have actually no hobbies.
Mm.
And growing up, being raised by a perfectionist mother, you're always not good enough.
Mm. Like so, when she noticed your hair, when you made this big speech that changed the whole community, she's talking about your hair not looking right.
But she's like, she loves me more than anybody else I've ever known in my life. So you're not hurt by the perfectionism.
Yeah.
It's just
it's probably like, how her parents judged her.
Imagine, right? I'm sure. That's the reason why she is the way she is.
Yeah.
And the reason why I got into so much of philanthropy is as a workaholic, once you get into that rabbit hole, you go deeper and deeper and deeper. And philanthropy is one of those, you know, things that once you start After School Stars, you can get into, you know, all these other related, you know, organizations
you were
that can work together.
You were on 21 charity boards?
I was on 21 boards. With the Weingart Center from Homeless Issues and American Friends of the Louvre. So the art community, you know, it was just like all over the place.
Wow.
And 2009 happened. Oh, so now I'm at Wharton commuting from LA to Philadelphia. I have Premier Business Bank. I have 21 charity boards. And first week when I was in Wharton, I saw this incredible opportunity for our inner city kids. Because I was working a lot with inner city kids.
Okay, and this is in Philadelphia, you
in
noticed
Philadelphia,
it? Okay.
In Philadelphia, because yeah. It's kind of like brotherly love. And our professors, this is a program, it was a joint degree program with the Wharton and Graduate School of Education.
Okay.
And everyone had this like great novel idea about saving the world, make the world a better place, and make your mark. And that was like a big thing. And I kept thinking about, you know, like this is the greatest country in the world with opportunities. Immigrants like me have all the opportunities that was possible. But I work with inner city kids who have no education, and we are 23 out of 25 developed countries in education system. When we test a STEM education, that's where we rank.
Wow.
And it's an embarrassment. And in a knowledge-driven economy, from industrial economy, the real gap between haves and have-nots is knowledge.
Yeah, education.
In education.
Yeah.
So
that creates the knowledge, and then if you don't have that, you're stuck.
Right. I told my professors that I knocked off Chanel and made a lot of money. Can I knock off Wharton and teach our inner city kids? And they said, still shamelessly, we're going to help you out.
Mm.
So every morning that week when I was in Wharton, we were in a Steinberg executive classroom, and we were drawing out different learning models and how we can effectively teach students with experiential learning and also, you know, like project-based learning instead of chalk and talk, which is a lecture-based.
Ah.
Because our kids learn so much more creatively. And I needed a laboratory. So I came home and bought Fremont College as a laboratory. It was actually Platt College at that time.
Okay, so it was a small college.
Like a shell of a college. It had 57 students. And
did you raise funds, or you just acquired it with your own?
Had enough money
out of pocket, yeah. And then it was to be your testing lab to
yeah,
figure
was,
out better education
exactly,
systems.
Exactly. And when I wanted to really change everything, I had one employee left because I had to let everybody go.
Mm.
And 57 students, we changed the name to Fremont College, and started doing a lot of research. And that research was really fascinating because our human brains have different core competencies. You know, you have a DNA to be tall or short. You have a DNA to be blue eyes or, you know, brown eyes. You have a DNA to be either creative, organized, data-driven, or very people-oriented. Ned Herman, who was the chief learning officer for GE, have done a 20-year longitudinal study. And I saw that study just really fascinating. And I wanted to do a study on top of that. So I developed a curriculum based on human core competencies and also putting human motivation of all these different scholars from B.F. Skinner, who put his kids in a box to do awards and punishment. That's like one of the...
He put his own kids in the rat. The Skinner
exactly,
box, I
right.
thought, was the
Skinner's
rat experiment.
Skinner's black box.
Yeah.
It's like a nightmare, right?
Oh, wow.
And, actually Skinner's kids like hated him so much when they grew up that he really was a very, very lonely man.
Mm.
And his daughter became a psychologist and realize how brilliant her father was and how committed he was with the craft. So, they co-produced some of the academic papers that is still to this date is a very, very important educational psychology model.
Oh, well, and for those who don't know, Skinner was the person who discovered that if you put rats in a box and there's a lever that they can push to have food come out, you can set it in different ways. And if they push the lever and the food comes out one by one, they will push it when they're hungry. And if they keep pushing it and food never comes out, they'll quickly give up. But, and I hope I'm explaining this
sure.
right.
Yeah.
If when the rat presses the lever and the food comes out at random times, they will keep pressing it basically yeah. forever. The randomness fools them. And if you think about it, that is how slot machines work. That's how Facebook and Instagram notifications
sure.
work.
Sure.
Like
yeah.
all of these addictive systems
sure.
that humans design, many are based on Skinner's research.
Yeah, he was a genius on rewards and punishment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. rewards
how,
and that, punishment.
Yeah, yeah, that's how we train circus animals. And that's how most of schools design their system.
Mm.
But when you do, then there's somewhat of a plateau of that motivation, unless you know it's something very addictive, and usually school work is not that addictive. So there's Jean-Paul Piaget who really talked about cognitive psychology, like of you know how human beings are naturally curious you know, species.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give enough, you know, enough curiosity to human beings, they'll learn naturally. But for me, the person who just really changed my perspective about learning was Lev Vygotsky. He was a Russian. Not many people know about him, but you know there are scholars who talk about Lev Vygotsky just so passionately because he was the one who brought in social culturalism. So for example, you're a white guy. If you were born in China, raised by Chinese parents, you would not know how to speak English. You'll be
yeah.
speaking Chinese.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
That's how we learn, by our environment.
By our environment.
So if you create the right environment for our students, then they'll learn. So I wanted to create an institution that we create, you know, we have all these segments and all these research, but we can create an environment that we can really help students to grow and nurture.
Mm. And that then, so you got the idea because of the Wharton education was so engaging for you,
yeah.
you decided to bring that back.
Sure. That was exactly what I wanted to do.
Amazing.
And that became Fremont College. And then we were growing like leaps and bounds and, you know, won all the awards. We became School of Distinction, School of Excellence by our Accreditation Commission. And 2015, the regulations start changing. I will always miss the grace and elegance of our President Obama. And he was a beautiful president. Some of his policies and regulations really hurt so many businesses.
Yeah.
And painted some sectors with one brush stroke that I never felt. I came here as a woman who didn't speak English, who didn't have a college degree, single mom. I was never prejudiced until I got into education.
Mm.
And that was a for-profit education. That brush stroke was so horrendous that I was embarrassed to be in education.
Mm.
But that did not stop me. The regulations were so horrible that the sector almost went completely bankrupt.
So you couldn't teach the way you wanted to anymore. Is that what it was? To maintain
yeah.
your accredited yeah.
and
status?
And just to give you just a little background, there was a algorithm that government put as a something called gainful employment. And that's only for for-profit colleges. Just tax difference. You know, as long as your tax-exempt state is nonprofit and the president of the university makes $5-6 million, you're still exempt on all of these.
Hmm.
But if the status is for profit, then this was all really a lot driven by short sellers because there was a publicly traded market of about $30 billion that they could have made. And the short sellers came in around 2010 when there was nothing too short because everything was just bare bottom in 2009 and 2010. They saw the for-profit college sector going in so high and just bet a lot the for-profit college sector going down. There are a lot of bad apples in every sector.
Yeah.
And so did this sector.
And then they get highlighted. And
absolutely.
The regulations.
And the regulations just came and killed everybody.
Oh, man.
And that was probably the one of the worst professional periods of my time, because every day I thought, we're going to go bankrupt. I was embarrassed and I was humiliated by being in the education sector. I didn't feel good about what I was doing. Employees were leaving because the media just bashed the private colleges so much.
Oh, wow.
I was on the board of the, at that time, Career College Association, which is a national association for the private colleges. And they changed the name of the association because career colleges became such a horrible, terrible word.
Wow.
Where I think medical schools are career colleges, law schools are career colleges. You're providing career. What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
That's what America's all about.
You learn things that are applicable, unlike at university, sometimes where you spend, what, it was 2 years with the general education stuff still?
Yeah. Yeah. So now, you know, I'm now almost finishing my, you know, college degree. I finished my college degree in 2009. I came back.
Yeah. I want to interrupt and just ask, how did it go with your mom when you got your first college degree? Was she happy or was she?
Oh, when I got my MBA, she was so happy. When I got my doctorate, she was a little confused because while I was going to Philadelphia, you know, now I have Fremont College, Premier Business Bank, Fashion Umbrella. I'm still on 21 charitable boards, and I'm commuting from LA to Philadelphia. I told my mother that, oh, you know, I saw people who didn't have a master's were taking doctorate because you can actually transfer all the doctor courses and get another master. You know, that sounds like that would have been a really cool thing to do. And she goes, no, you couldn't have done that because you don't have a bachelor's. And I was like, Mom, you're right. And then she goes, but this is 50% off. You should definitely do that and get another master. So now I have like two masters, you know, the second master that I'm working on. And she said, you know, it's a joint doctorate program. Do both. So I'm doing both of doctorate programs. Like 2009 was a horrible year for me. You know, you don't know what your limit is until you get there.
Yeah.
That was my limit.
Yeah, you're taking on a lot.
Yeah, I was taking on a lot. And then I saw stock market coming down, and my net worth is less than 50%.
Oh, because you were invested.
I was fully invested. Mm-hmm. So I cashed out.
Mm.
March of 2009. Mm. If you look at the graph, that's literally the bottom.
Oh,
I felt
wow.
great for a whole week.
Oh, wow.
And then I saw it keep going up and going up and because I was just so emotional about money.
Yeah.
I was so emotional about everything. I was driven by fear.
Yeah.
And that fear, anxiety, and trying to please was my biggest motivation.
Yeah.
And it's a great motivator. Fear is a great motivator, but it is just a cruel master.
No doubt. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. Wow. Well, if it makes you feel any better, I cashed out at the bottom of the crypto markets. So I know how you feel. They started going, now they're way back up. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
so.
we just, you know, when people ask me, like, why did you cash out all of it? Like, there's no rational, like, explanation. You're just emotionally
you know, it feels
driven.
Like you're going to lose it all in situations like that.
And
that's what it felt like for me.
Yeah.
Like I'm gonna cash out,
I can still live for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But if it goes down further, I'm not gonna feel then, very good.
Yeah.
You know?
Go back to folding.
Sure. And at that time, 2009, I heard President Obama giving a speech about nationalizing all the banks. And I owned the bank, and that bank was like sucking up money. Fremont College was sucking up money. I was so devoted to these businesses.
Yeah.
And I was the only person who can fund these businesses, and I wanted to have cash. So that's kind of like my rationale at that time.
Yeah.
looking back, it's a stupid decision. I completely agree. But at that time...
At that time, you made what was the best decision at the time. Yeah. So you can't regret it.
And it's just, what's really good about it is I slept every night.
Yes.
After that.
I mean, that's priceless. It really is, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, wow. It's so amazing. And I know you've since sold Fremont College.
So, 2016, Trump becomes a president. And now... most of the private sector colleges are gone.
Mm.
Like, if you look at all the household names, ITT, DeVry, University of Phoenix, they're all gone.
They're gone?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They're gone. Westwood, I mean, like, billions and billions of dollars gone.
Wow.
And students are out on the street. Some are very deserving. Some, not all, were deserving. But since government took out all the competition again, so I was in two very regulatory-driven businesses, bank and a college, mm-hmm. and the regulations really took out all the competition. I went through just a big storm in both sectors. In 2018... both sectors were doing really well, both businesses. And I looked at my life, and I didn't want to be driven by fear and anxiety anymore. And my mother started getting sick too. And investors were not proud to be part of the organization because of all the publicity, negative publicity that's out there.
Mm.
So we made a decision to sell. So 2018, I sold Premier Business Bank to First Foundation. 2019, I sold Fremont College to Greybull Capital. And last Friday, I sold Dale Carnegie to Success Education. So all the operating businesses are pretty much sold.
Mm.
And my mother passed away.
Mm. A lot of having at once.
Yeah.
I'm sure your mother...
I'm going to take a little break. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So you've started... Shoot, I can't even keep track of how many amazing businesses and had some incredible exits. What are some of the biggest lessons you learned along the way that other people can use to try to do the same?
Yeah, I think starting a business is somewhat easier than exiting the business. Anyone can start, but actually successful exit is very difficult to
really do. Really tough, yeah.
Yeah, it's very tough to do because along the way, there are so many peaks and valleys and most people give up during the valleys.
Yeah.
And how you can survive during those struggles really gives you the trajectory of what your success is going to be in your life.
Mm.
When you're starting the business, I think very important thing is, I call it my five fingers.
Okay.
You need to have that infrastructure. Even if it's one or two people, you need to have the infrastructure to really grow the business. And that, you know, first infrastructure, most important infrastructure is a product. And most people just start with an idea, but you need to have like literally the best product.
The best product that
best
has
product
demand.
Of whatever that you're selling or you know, a service or a product.
So when you made that bank, you looked at what business owners wanted and you created the best types
best
of
possible.
Loans and different programs
right.
that they could have
and,
in the bank.
You know, it's so much easier to get into a niche market and be the best in that niche market than trying to be Coca-Cola.
Yes.
It's very difficult.
Well, that's
to
what
be.
You did with design college.
Yeah, California Design
You weren't
design
trying
college.
To compete against
right.
USC and
sure.
Cal State Long Beach.
It was just fashion and Korean market only.
Yeah.
And then it grew. And because we had infrastructure, when other students came in, no problem at all. And we're actually teaching everything in English to begin with. You know, we weren't teaching it in Korean. Same thing with a bank. We started as a multi-ethnic bank with... about $5 million to $50 million businesses, smaller businesses, and giving them the type of loans and opportunities like private banks do.
You picked that niche of businesses and you thought, okay, what are the specific type of products that these businesses need?
Sure. And it's because my, you know, co-founder and the one of the, you know, biggest investors of the bank was one of the largest real estate developers.
So he knew all the
businesses. A lot of the tenants.
Yeah.
And the tenants were $5 to $50 million businesses.
Yeah.
So that was just, you know, you go where your market is and what that market needs are with that product. And same thing with the Fremont College. I had all the connections with, you know, employers, because by now I'm in so many different organizations, with the Young Presidents Organization to, you know, different charities, and, you know, there's so many connections with the business community, and I knew the needs of the business community. I also had a lot of connections with inner city kids and the needs of the inner city, and connected those two. So you make the best product possible.
Amazing, yeah.
And the second is sales and marketing. You know, if you don't know your customer, you should not have a business. And most of the time, people talk about, oh, I have a great idea. And, you know, what is your business? And people talk about their product or service. But you always have to start with your customer. And that customer is the most important thing. And it's not just treating the customer, it's knowing the psyche of the customer.
Yeah.
Right? And where's their pain point, and how can I solve that problem?
Yes, I always say it's not about what you want, it's about what they,
want.
So stop talking about it in the way you want to hear about it. Talk
Absolutely.
About your product in the way they want to hear it.
That's going to speak and they can understand
to their dreams.
Absolutely.
And yes, easy to understand.
Yeah. That simplicity and the beauty of Steve Jobs is he can talk human, not tech.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it's like 1,000 songs in your pocket. There's no tech in that word.
Yeah.
And that's how you need to talk to your customers. And the third is, you know, like most people don't combine operations and technology, but nowadays operations is technology. If you don't have the infrastructure technology, then there's no operations. The systems and features that comes with that operations is so important. And the fourth is the accounting and finance. And a lot of startups, they just outsource, you know, like accounting and finance, and CEOs and the people with co-founders don't even care because it's someone else's money.
Mm-hmm.
And they also think, you know, that private equity is going to care about the money. But private equity is there to provide money for you. Money is like a raw ingredient. It's not a steak. It's a cow. You need to make that into beef. And not only that, you're not going to eat that whole steak raw. You have to season it and make it into a dish and then put it in a beautiful package to sell.
Yeah.
And private equity is giving you a cow.
Yes, so funny. So true.
So a lot of startups think about money like that's one of the most important things. I got to raise money. If you don't have this infrastructure, money is not going to do anything.
Right.
Interesting enough.
You're just going to blow it.
Yeah.
And if you're running at too big of a loss, I mean, it's a rare time right now when you see companies that are able to do that, but that's not going to last forever.
Yeah. You know, but money solves a lot of problems in business.
Yeah.
So weirdly enough, if you know how to raise money, the company will keep going, but there will be an end.
There will. Absolutely.
Right? And there will not be an exit.
Yes, unless you find someone that wants to take on all that debt or take on your bleeding company.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that exit is not going to be a pretty exit.
Yeah. And these companies like WeWork, for example, that have come to the market or considered coming to market, they didn't even make it to market because they were bleeding off so much cash.
Yeah.
Are changing the landscape. So I think that we've been in a rare period where companies have been able to raise money and sell products at huge operating loss, But the market is refusing them now. You know, you can see the valuation of Casper Mattress, which loses like $300 every mattress they sell. They lose $300. There was a blogger that made a point that their business model would improve if their business model was just standing on the corner giving $300 to them to walk by, because they wouldn't have to do all this stuff. It's crazy.
Right.
But their valuation that they were going for, I think, got cut more than in half when they went to the public markets. So
yeah,
I think
same thing with the Kmart when they first, you know, started, when they bought the Kmart, they said exactly the same thing. You know,
yeah.
We're going to lose every $10 for every customer who comes in, but we're going to have a great company.
Yeah.
So what is your business model? If your business model is, for example, real estate, and you can, you know, float it, because that's what everyone was suspecting because of the equity that's going in the real estate, then Kmart can maybe afford to lose the money. Amazon, because it was going after the market share with the infrastructure and we will eventually make money, you can afford to lose the money at the beginning. So it really depends on how you structure it. But one of the most important thing is that organizational structure. You know, that the fifth is obviously taking care of the customer. So that customer service and the feedback of customer service to marketing, to operations, that constant feedback of the five is very, very important. And if you look at it, Amazon is excellent at that.
Yes,
that
they've always anticipated customers' needs and built around them.
Yeah, and that recommended for thing is it's a killer. You know, it's like, I don't need these, but Amazon told me that I do.
Yeah, other people bought this.
Yeah, somehow it feels like I need it, right?
Yeah.
And somehow I just grab so many great things because of that feedback loop that Amazon developed. And as our machine learning is getting stronger each day, I think we can learn so much of consumer behavior. And if you're ahead of that curve, you'll get better product and better services for the consumers.
Well said. And that goes into creating new products too. Mm-hmm. You can take those feedback loops and study them, study the data, study what your customers like, and design the next product that they want. Don't design the next product that you want.
Sure.
Then you'll have a successful launch. If you let them tell you, we like to survey our customers and we will ask them straight up, we'll send them a list of five products. Which of these would you want to buy next?
Mm-hmm.
Just ask them and they will tell you.
Yeah.
And then once you get the winner, put it against four others and say, which of these would you like to buy next, and see if it wins again.
Yeah.
And then you know what product to make, so you avoid a flop. You know, so many businesses just guess, and they make what they want to make and not getting that customer feedback. So,
So
I'm so in agreement.
Yeah.
So
startup is really that simple in a sense that you have a business infrastructure, make the good product, and have the constant feedback of these five golden fingers that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then you just keep doing the same thing. And not losing the sight of what's happening in the trend. So that that consistency is so important, because everyone talks about innovation, but innovation is so overrated because you cannot innovate every single day.
Right. And innovation, it can be copied so quickly these days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, my joke when I was doing my fashion company is, why innovate when you can imitate? Because it was so much faster and better.
Yeah.
And you just do slightly better. And we have seen so much innovation failing.
Yeah.
But transformation is what's really, really important.
Yeah. When you're the innovator, you're going to have people that follow what you do and do the exact same thing. So the way to stay ahead of them is, I don't think you should stop innovating, but it really comes down to just knowing what customers want, treating them right, and then everything that you added on top of that to make the offering go out smoothly and, I think, as profitable as possible, or as close to break even as possible if you want to be playing the long game.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, the execution, even mediocre ideas that's executed beautifully will succeed a lot more and go much further and have a much better exit than beautiful idea that's poorly executed.
Well, it's like McDonald's is not the best tasting burger.
Right.
And look at
that. But look at that infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know what's really genius about McDonald's is, number one, you know, I don't go to McDonald's, so I don't know, but, you know, like Big Mac, French fries, and milkshake. Most people take those, like number two, number three. You know what it does? It cuts down so much of human error and time on a fast food restaurant. Those are two things that's really important.
Yeah.
Right? Human error and time. So customers order that way. The back off, you know, the cashier who is minimum wage person also
can just put in number two.
One number instead of punching three different things.
Removes so much human error. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And instead of customers going, oh, let me get Big Mac and let's see, maybe French fries. They just say,
maybe,
well,
or maybe what size do those fries come in?
Right.
You know, maybe I'll get a medium. Was that enough for one person? You know, just here it is. Boom.
That cuts down so much time.
Yeah. There's the old world marketing. If you give someone too many choices, they'll choose zero.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't think someone's not going to order, but it's going to hold up the line. They're going to be paralyzed with what choices to make. You know, so such a great point. I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
And In-N-Out's even more streamlined.
Yeah, it's even
smaller
right?
menu, but yeah.
But if you look at it, McDonald's is operating several billion-dollar company with minimum wage people.
That's so true.
Their widgets.
Super simple.
Super simple.
That's so true. Such a great
point.
And
it's because of the infrastructure.
That is a great, that's a great way to explain the importance of infrastructure.
Right.
If minimum wage people can operate it at a billion-dollar level, multiple billion-dollar level, it's got to be simple and it's got to be human error proof.
Absolutely. And look at that. That infrastructure also prevents anyone stealing from it.
Yes, yes.
Right?
It's
because you can't calculate how to, you know, you can't steal from McDonald's.
Yeah.
Because there are so many different hands and how, and they're all cash business. And fast food restaurants, employees steal all the time. But at McDonald's, it's almost impossible.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, you know, my wife, their family had Subway restaurants and theft was a big problem.
Right. But at McDonald's, it's almost impossible because of the infrastructure.
Because of the infrastructure.
So Warren Buffett said something really like that resonated in my heart for a long time, which is you got to create a business that fools and thieves can run because someday fools and thieves will run your business.
Oh my gosh. It's
Isn't that
so
awesome?
Wild. Yeah. That's so wild. And when it comes to, I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, right. Every business owner, every entrepreneur have gone through the pain of fools and thieves.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
And
wow.
And it comes from like the best of the people in weird circumstances. And
we all make a bad decision once in a while.
But you don't know.
We can protect against that.
Yeah, you don't know.
Wow, yeah.
But if
love
you
jamming with you on this stuff.
You know, that's infrastructure, that's really most important thing in business.
Yeah.
One other thing that I think it's really important for, you know, like young CEOs to know is that it's okay to be fearful. Just that gives your edge. You're just not going to go with that fear base forever. Just know that. But it's okay. If you're not scared, I'm scared for you.
I love that.
As an investor.
Permission to be afraid.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Just be really scared.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Keep you on your toes.
Yeah.
And the
and
fear
it's okay.
is good. It'll keep you
I think
in.
Fear really drove me where I am today.
Mm.
And if you just know how to channel that fear with energy, you know, the positive energy and getting things done and making your goals and, you know, like just so many, we have so many fears and we need approval of others. And when you're young, that's okay. In your 20s, you know, all these self-help stuff that I'm doing right now, I'm so glad I didn't know that when I was in my 20s. You know, had I known I meditated too much or I didn't need any approval from others and I didn't care about what my mother thought, I don't know if I would be here today.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, some of the most powerful business creators in the world have operated from these core wounds as a child, you know, trying to please parents or fill a wound in themselves that says they're not good enough. You know, it's created great things for the world. It's interesting because it makes me think coming into fatherhood. You know, Sarah and I are trying to start a family this year.
Yeah, I know. Congratulations. Like,
thank you. Yeah.
Not yet, though, right?
Not yet, but soon, soon.
Yeah.
You know, if we raise our kids perfectly and zen-like, maybe they just become monks and live in the forest, you know? But that's going to be a perfectly happy life. Yeah. And nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think one of the reasons why I was driven to become financially successful is because my parents were quite frugal growing up. Mm-hmm. I always had food on the table. The lights were always on at a you know, roof over our head. But, you know, Christmas presents would often come from garage sales. And the rule was we couldn't buy a food item at the store unless we had a coupon. Mm-hmm. And that was my goal. I was like, I want to be able to buy any food whenever I want.
Yeah.
I want to be able to buy any toy whenever I want.
Amazing.
I want to be able to go buy a car without having to negotiate, you know, but I still negotiate because that's also part of my upbringing. But I think that's part of the reason why I've always wanted to be successful is because of that upbringing.
Yeah.
And my mom was raised even more frugal than she raised us. You know, it was like one bike for five kids and things like that, you know. So, yeah.
All of our adversaries that we have as a child, it just is a seed for us to succeed.
A seed to succeed. I love that.
Yeah.
Yes. One of the things I say when I speak on stage is your shit is your superpower. The shit you went through, you got through that, and then it becomes strength. You literally turn it into strength.
Yeah. And you got to know what your seeds are. And once you know that, and you know it's not going to be seed forever. It's going to be a tree. It's going to be a flower. It's going to just grow to be something else.
Yes.
But while it's a seed, it's okay to be scared. It's okay just knowing that the anger, fear, sadness, and all of that is really your motivator to be greater than yourself.
Yeah. So did you name your book yet? Because your seeds are your strength is a cool name for a book. You know?
I'm still struggling with the book.
Yeah, I'm so excited for you to get it out because you have so many lessons and so much to share.
You know, now the biggest lesson I have for me is nothing is going to be constant.
Mm, yeah.
And people tell me that, but I've never really experienced it. And it's the second time that I've literally sold everything. And people ask me, like, what's next? I'm not sure. A lot of people ask me, like, how do you feel? I don't know.
Changes, yeah. Change is the only constant.
Yeah, change is the only constant.
Yeah.
And at this point, what I'm most interested in is the mental health issues.
And I know you're really passionate about mental wellness. Is that something you're planning on getting into for your next project now that you have a clean slate?
Yeah, you know, last few years, it's been very interesting because, like I said, you know, I was like really driven by fear and anxiety and approval of others. I was just really a pathetic pleaser. You know, like I just wanted my mom to love me, my dad to love me, my brothers to love me, everyone around me to love me. And that was so important to me. And, you know, when I was doing my TV shows and radios, I was so afraid that people would find out that I was a single mom because I was, you know, supposed to be a role model for all these young people. And in the Korean community, single moms are not role models.
Mm.
Divorced is not, you know, they're not role
it's
models.
Not an option.
I never ever talked about it. Not only that, I didn't even go and have lunch with my brother in public, thinking that some people may think that I'm dating someone.
Oh, wow.
And everywhere I went, my father came with me.
Wow.
So that, you know, people would think that, you know, we are business partners. Being with my dad, it just gave me the credibility that I needed as a woman. All of that, I think I started learning a lot more about what real self-confidence and self-compassion look like. So easy to say that, and if anyone look at me, and no one's gonna say, oh, she has a low self-esteem, but we're all insecure. all humans are insecure. And if anyone says, I have no insecurities, that's a person who's really insecure and who's really afraid of that insecurities. So our insecurities are our strength, but it's not the strength that you can go with forever either.
Yes, yes.
So if you look at life like a river, the rivers have different waves and then areas that's really wide and the areas that's very narrow and fast and high streams. But at the end, the rivers really run into this beautiful ocean and the calmness of the ocean. And it, you could become part of something that's greater than river. You know, and that all oceans really come from that river.
Beautiful way to describe it. Yeah.
I really wanted to discover what that self-compassion looked like. In the last few years, I have gone through a lot of different, you know, modalities to access that. And once you learn how to really love yourself, then you know how to truly love others and be loving and lovable.
So true. Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful journey and it's lifelong, you know, and that's so true about the insecurities. And I think that's going to help a lot of people that are listening to know that even someone as successful as you has insecurities. I have insecurities like crazy. Even how am I going to look on this camera? And did I sound okay when I just responded to that awesome story Sabrina said? Was my expression the right one? And, you know, all these thoughts. It's just the human mind is full of chatter.
Yeah. Yeah. And all these like great words that people give us as an advice, like don't worry about what other people think. We're social animals. We're going to worry about what other people think.
Yeah.
You know, so how do we still worry about what other people think? Worry may not be the right choice of words. Be cognizant about what other people think, but still love yourself the way you are. And those are kind of like life challenges that you can really have through meditation, through different practices. You know, there are things that I have done that's really helpful. One is called expressive writing.
Okay.
And at night, if there's anything that really bothered me either that day or things that's been bothering me for a long time, I just write. I have 20 minutes. I put it on a clock. And I just write.
Just write it out.
Write it out and then tear it out and burn it.
Yeah.
Tear it out in small pieces and I put it in a little bowl, the metal bowl.
Yeah.
And then make a sound.
Yeah.
And meditate and then burn it.
That's great. Yeah.
And so that, you know, people say, some people say like, oh, I'm such a great writer. I want to keep it. I don't want to keep the things that's in my head.
Yeah.
It's gone. You know, you want to make it to be like symbolically out of your system.
That's great. Yeah, I was just at a workshop that you know of.
And that we were.
We did the same workshop at different times. And what I liked about their writing exercise was they said, write like you're an angry kid and you know, don't worry about the grammar. Just write angry. Be like, oh, yeah, I'm so damn angry about this. And why did you do this? And how dare? And, you know, it gets a lot of emotion out. And it's just getting it out of your body because if you don't express it out, it stays in and it haunts you. And it turns into things like insomnia or even ulcers and physical health issues. It's so important to get it out. There's, so that's a great method.
Yeah, there's a great doctor, John Sorno, who wrote Healing Your Back. My mother passed away having two fusion surgeries. She was filleted like a salmon, and all of her back bones were replaced.
Oh, wow.
But Dr. Sarno was a spine surgeon, basically saying 90% of the spine surgery is unnecessary. After mom passed away, I read that book again. I read that book a long time ago, but it didn't click to me until my mom passed away. And I was very close to her. I was with her every day. I got the best doctors. And I think she died because of her perfectionism. And she was never able to express and never had that relaxing moment. She was always worried about everything. And that made her who she is. You know, she's got three kids and both of my brothers are medical doctors. And we came from nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And she also drove my dad, you know, to be a very successful person. I think it just whatever made you successful can also kill you.
Yeah.
So we have to understand what the change really does for you at what period of our time. And, you know, people say, like, money cannot buy you happiness, so don't worry about money. But poverty can also kill happiness, so do worry about money.
Yeah. You know, what I really love about what you shared is that we're all going to feel these fears and we're all going to feel these insecurities, and you shouldn't shame yourself.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's totally normal. And what I really love about you and your story is you felt these fears as someone coming here who didn't speak the language, you know, feeling the insecurities, the pressure from your parents, and you just kept going. But you didn't push the fears and the insecurities aside. You let yourself feel them, but you kept on going. You didn't let them stop you. I just think it's so beautiful and such a great example for people out there who are feeling some hesitancy or some anxiety, that it's okay to feel that. Don't shame yourself. Feel the feelings and just keep going. Just keep moving.
And you're talking about shame. I think shame is very momentary. Shame is for right now. For example, when I got pregnant, I was so ashamed. I didn't tell anybody except my mom and dad. My brothers didn't know until I was really pregnant.
Oh, wow.
I dropped out of college because I didn't want my friends to find out. Oh. I didn't have any friends until my daughter was like about 4 or 5 years old.
Mm. Wow.
I was so ashamed of not graduating from college. I never told anyone. I was so fearful that someone was going to find out.
Wow.
Now I have 2 masters and a doctorate without a college degree. That's kind of cool. So I talk about it. I'm like, what happened for something that I was so ashamed that I tried so hard to hide is now are the things that I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
You know?
The seeds turn into the strength.
Exactly. It's just very, very momentary. So just knowing that when you feel that shame, just know that it's going to pass.
It's going to pass. And it's probably going to make you stronger.
It's
the thing
you
feel the shame about is probably going to make you stronger long term.
Sure. It's a foundation.
It builds resilience. Yeah.
And the only way you're going to fail is by quitting.
That's right. Sabrina, thank you so much for sharing this today. This has been so incredible to hear your story. How will people find out more about you? Are you on Instagram, or do you have a website? Or where can people go?
I'm very unsocial in a social media. But,
I know, you're not out there, and that's why I'm so appreciative of you being here and sharing today. But I know you have a book in the works.
Well,
people that
we'll
listen to this are going to want to know more about what you're up to. So is there a place people can go to learn more?
I do have an Instagram account. Okay. It's Dr. Dr. Sabrina K.
Okay, Dr. Sabrina K.
Yes, K-A-Y.
On Instagram.
Yeah.
Great. And I love the shares that you put on there. You just honored Demi Moore at the Oscars the other day.
She has an incredible story.
Yeah. So go follow Sabrina, Dr. Sabrina K. on Instagram. Thank you so much for being here. This has been really special. I really appreciate you.
It was really wonderful.
Thanks so much for watching. If you want to hear a story that's even wilder than that one, click here. You only have 5 seconds though. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!